Oscars.
Speak and Destroy is the podcast featuring interviews about Metallica, and I'm your host, Ryan J. Downey. My guest this episode is comedian Don Jameson, stand-up comedian who first rose to prominence in the metal world as co-host of VH1 Classics' That Metal Show. He's a prolific joke writer, he's been heard on The Howard Stern Show, and he's an Emmy Award winner for his work on HBO's Inside the NFL. Jameson has released 4 comedy albums and toured as the opening act for Andrew Dice Clay and the band Pop Evil. He's hung out with the Metallica guys several times, and even performed at the inaugural Orion Music and More Festival, where he was brought on stage and introduced by Lars Ulrich. A great way to support the podcast is to go into Apple Podcasts, leave a 5-star rating, and write a nice little review. Like this one from Burning Fight, which says, "Excellent, informative, unique. As with all of his projects, Ryan Downey conveys his passion for the subject with an informed yet down-to-earth perspective." Wow, thank you. "Thus far, the content and presentation are engaging and fun. Downey is arguably among the top Metallica historians slash nerds out there, and his devotion to the band brings about fantastic episodes. Great so far." Thanks, Burning Fight. Problematique3 says, "Awesome professional podcast. The host is an eloquent-sounding fan of this amazing band that us, the listeners, love and sometimes worship. A fan for a decade and a half now, I may not be an old-school fan, but I love all of their music, old and new. Creative, original, unique, with a varied catalog, no two albums are the same. Their songs are fast, slow, mid-tempo, technical, emotional, and melodic are their songs. They aren't a perfect band, but they are definitely my band." PhantomLord03 says, "Most intriguing Metallica podcast. There are a few other Metallica podcasts out there, but what I really like about this podcast is getting to see a different side of Metallica through the eyes of those within the industry. I consider myself someone who is very knowledgeable about Metallica, and it's great to find a podcast where I can continue to learn new things about my favorite band. The interviews are really great and thorough, and the guests are pretty phenomenal. Keep up the good work, and I look forward to many more episodes. P.S. He may sound like Seth Rogen, but he's not." That's an inside joke I should probably explain at some point. I might have already on the podcast. In the meantime, you can follow me on Twitter at Ryan Downey and on Instagram at SuperheroHQ. You can find Speak and Destroy at SpeakandDestroy.com and follow Speak and Destroy on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. Please subscribe to this podcast and the others in the Pop Curse Podcast Network, including Pop Curse and No Prize from God. So here it is, my conversation with comedian Don Jameson. This is Speak and Destroy.
I'm an open book, so you can ask me anything.
Perfect. Well, then the first thing I want to ask you about is my good friend and longtime management client, Zeus, tells me that you have the worst farts he's ever smelled come out of a human being in his life. And he said that that's the first thing I should ask you about.
Okay, so we've started the podcast. All right. Yes. We're just dropping a bomb, as it were, right from the beginning.
Pun intended.
Yeah, I've got a couple of good stories. The one he's referring to was when he was recording with the Murder Dolls in L.A., and Florentine and I were out there filming That Metal Show, and they said, "Hey, why don't you come up to the studio and hang?" Which was, you know, a huge mistake on their part. little did they know, Ryan. Yeah. Whatever was going on, in whatever injustices were going on inside my stomach, I took out in their studio, and I drove everybody out of the studio except for 2 people. You know, Joey Jordison ran out, Zeus ran out. The only people that stayed in, actually, I think the only person that stayed in was Wednesday 13, and he was defiant. He just sat there and he looked at the other guys and he goes, Guys, come on. This band deserves to be in Stink."
I was going to say, he probably had some kind of spooky, supernatural summoning, like, you know, the dark magic of the cloud that you had left. Yeah, he did something evil with it.
Yeah, and their tour manager at the time, Sully.
Oh, yeah, Sully the Bull, another old friend of mine.
Yeah, so Sully texted Florentine like in the middle of the night that night, and he said, I had to get up at 3 in the morning and go to, you know, the 24-hour Ralph's and get, like, mouthwash because I could still the taste and the smell was still in my head. I couldn't get it out.
It just lingered. Did you have to let it linger?
Oh, wow. Yeah. And then the other one that I'll tell you is...
And real quick before we get off of that one, and which we can definitely get off of it, but Zeus said that he's got photos of you know, guys... like pulling their shirts up over their face. But go on. So yeah, so there's more.
Now, Ryan, why is it for guys that it's still funny when we're in our 50s? I mean, it is.
I don't know, but it is. I laughed so hard when he told me that. I was literally just talking to him right before we got on. I said, oh, I got to go. I'm interviewing Don Jameson for the Metallica podcast. And he was like, Don Jameson.
Let me tell you something about that guy. So I connected with that, Jim and I got to be good friends with Joey Jordison. And when Slipknot headlined Madison Square Garden for their very first time, Joey texted us. He's like, guys, please come to the show. We're so excited. You know, this is, and he's a big Andrew Dice Clay fan, like Jim and I were, and still are. Mm-hmm. And, he's like, I can't believe I'm playing where Dice headlined and all these other great Zeppelin, you know, and all that, and Kiss. And so he was really excited. And we knew Mick, but we didn't know Corey yet. But this is the first time I met Corey. It was at the after party. After we were all, they had a party, like there's a secret bar in the middle of the Madison Square Garden. And we went down there and we're hanging out. And I don't know what was going on, you know, in my innards, but it was bad. And when Florentine's there, he eggs me on, you know, so I let a little out, he starts giggling, and then, you know, the floodgates open. So we're standing there, I think with the guys at Mastodon and Coheed and Cambria were there, and Richard Christie from the Stern Show was there, mm-hmm. wearing a diaper, of course. And it was a wonderful celebration until I just lost control. And the next thing you know, it's me and Jim giggling like 6-year-olds on one side and like 200 people all the way on the other side of the room. It reeks so bad,
right? Because Jim's probably developed a certain immunity, right, at this point, just from being around the the hazardous
gas.
Well,
his are bad too. He once tried to sell me one of his cars that he was getting rid of, but I said your farts are too deep in the fabrics, I'll never get it out. So we're just going to do an hour on farts, by
indeed.
The way.
This will be the first episode my kids love. So.
And then Corey Taylor is coming down the hallway. We see him coming into the bar area where they're having the party, and his fist is up in the air, and he's going, yeah, motherfucker. You know, I don't know if I was supposed to say that, but.
Oh, that's pretty fun.
Yeah, mother effer, we just headlined Madison Square Garden, man, let's party. And 20 seconds after he got into the party, he just went, oh my God, what is that smell? It smells like beer and shit. And he took off and he ran out of the party, and I ruined it for him. His first time headlining the Garden, completely ruined by this idiot from a basic cable show with bad farts.
Could it have smelled worse than the inside of their masks? Because I've heard tales about the vomit and sweat and spit and, you know, stank breath and everything else that gets fogged up inside those masks. So if it shocked one of those guys, it had to be truly shocking.
Yeah, and then when he came and did that metal show for the first time, he's like, oh, I remember you. I go, the farts? He goes, yeah, man. That night at the Garden was brutal, man. I go, yeah, sorry.
Well, are you ready for the greatest segue in the history of podcasting?
Let's go.
Have you ever farted in front of Metallica?
No. Why? Have you?
No. I'm just, you know, being, it's the Metallica podcast, and we're talking about
that's,
farts.
Oh, yeah, right. Speak and destroy. No.
Maybe it wasn't the greatest segue in the history of podcasting, then.
No,
I oversold it.
You just reminded me that on that metal show, Jim and I farted while Slash was on.
Why is this funny?
I don't know, but if
I'm like, hey, you know, my favorite comedians are like Norm Macdonald and Anthony Jeselnik. You know, I like some smart comedy. Why is this so funny to me?
Well, it's just because I'm farting on rock stars, you know? I mean, it's like, you're not, anybody else would be so excited. And Slash is a great guy, and we've met him a bunch of times. But I think that same day, we used to tape two shows, and on the first show, Heart was on. And it's like, you know, we're not going to do that
in
front of Heart. By the time Slash got out there for the second show, Jim and I were like, you know, we had eaten catering and all that stuff.
And you'd been holding it in around the sisters, you know, so.
Yeah. And so now he and I, then I, of course, you know, one of us started and the other one, you know, picked up on it. And we both started and we got backstage after the taping. We're like, Slash, was that all right? And he goes, yeah, it was fine. But man, it fucking stunk out there.
And do you confess at that point, or do you just go, what was that?
whenever there was a situation where Jim and Eddie and I were in the same room and there was farting, Jim and I would instinctually just both point at Eddie.
Oh, brilliant.
You know,
poor Eddie.
Blame it on the big guy.
I was going to say, it's sadly believable. Oh, man. Yeah, I've had the opportunity to meet and interview Slash in a few different settings. And yeah, super, super nice and chill guy. I actually did I interviewed him for Dave Mustaine's new book, the book about the making of Rust in Peace. Mm-hmm. And it was the 11th hour, like the book was finished and about to go to press. And then Dave calls up his management and says, hey, we should get Slash in the book. And the guy who wrote the book with Dave was already like off the gig, like it was all wrapped up and whatever. So long story short, New Year's Day, actually, one of my buddies at Dave's management called me and asked me if I wanted to talk to Slash for the book. And then I had the idea once I got talking with Slash, I was like, hey, what, you know, this is great stuff. I don't know how they plan on integrating it into the already finished book. How would you feel about me turning this into a foreword? And that ended up forward by Slash as told too. So pretty psyched about that.
Your interviews are great, man. So that's cool that you got to do that.
Yeah, it was super fun. So let's start at the beginning, so to speak, which is, and this is going to be a fun kind of dual question given the nature of your overlapping interests and mine. When and how did you first fall in love with music? Same question, comedy. And for both things, when did you turn the corner where you realized, okay, this isn't just something I love, this is something I need to participate in, I need to create, I'm not just in the audience, I gotta be in this?
For me, being turned on to both of them seemed almost simultaneous, because I can remember being, you know, like probably 12 years old and having Kiss Destroyer and George Carlin Occupation Fool at the same time, and thinking sort of the same thing about both, like, this is great because my parents hate both of these.
Yeah.
So I immediately love both of these.
And these things are both smarter than they look, you know? Like, people assume that it's something really dumb, and then when you actually dig into it, it's like, no, it's has much more value than you might realize, and much more value than things that you probably think are valuable.
Yeah. And so once you know it, you understand that it's subversive for some reason, especially at 12, you love it even more. And I don't know, man. I always made that connection in my brain between comedy and hard rock and metal before I was a performer. I just always found the humor in, you know, I mean, how could you not, you know, find humor in a bunch of grown men wearing clown makeup and Halloween costumes, you know?
Yes, indeed.
But simultaneously, Ryan, it was the coolest thing ever. You know, they're superheroes, they're comic book characters, and they're rock stars all wrapped up into one. But yeah, back in the back of my mind, I always thought, like, yeah, there's definitely inherent humor in all this stuff. And even though I didn't understand a lot of the things that George Carlin was talking about at the time, again, I just knew, like, you know, my parents can't hear me listening to this, you know, I gotta wait till they go to bed. So those two worlds I always loved.
I love the idea of the intersection there. Yeah, because for me, I there were a lot of things in pop culture that I love: music, comic books, comedy, and especially as an adult, I realized maybe, I guess, 5 or 10 years ago, I've always loved stand-up comedy. Of course, there's this like boon of it right now. Watched a lot of the classic HBO specials, had some of the albums, followed different comedians, but really in the last like 10 years, I had this moment where I was like, you know, after being so immersed, I think on the professional side in music and film, TV and all that stuff, I had this new sort of renaissance. It was almost like discovering heavy metal for the first time all over again, of getting really into comedy and then going like, hey, I live in California. There's all these great comedians all the time working out new stuff, coming up with, you know, their notes and, you know, playing in these tiny rooms and stuff. And I'm that guy that comes to your shows by himself. Like, you know, when you see the weirdo that's like the comedy nerd who's like, he's not even with a bunch of friends. He's just here. Yeah. He's not drinking. He's just here. I turned into that guy a few years ago. And, you know, there's just something about the culture of it, the community of it, the art of it. And so, of course, naturally, being a metal guy all my life, I feel a certain kinship with what you do and what Florentine does and Brian Posehn and, you know, some of the metal comics, if you will. Not to say that you're just in that box, because what all of you do, I think, is broader than that. I don't, you probably know Dean Del Rey.
Of course.
I just had Dean on the podcast a little while back. I've known Dean for a while. And yeah, and he's another one, you know, where it's like he doesn't want to be in the box of the rock and roll comic. And yet he's, you know, it's like, dude, your podcast is named after AC/DC. Yeah. You are. Yeah. But anyways, that's just, there's not really a question in there, but that's just more show and tell, I guess.
There's a certain rebellion in both art forms, you know? Mm. So for me, the next connection, and I wear it proudly on my sleeve, you know, I don't want to be billed as the rock and roll comic when I play a regular comedy club. But if that portion of my audience, you know, knows me for that, of course I love that, because I go out and open for bands. So, you know, I definitely wear that proudly. And, the second time it really started to make sense to me, Ryan, was when comics became rock stars, like when Dice put on the leather jacket. He had the attitude. He's opening for Guns N' Roses in front of 80,000 people. You know, Kinnison with the Wild Thing, hanging out with Slash and all the Sunset Strip bands and
Kinnison, big stars time. I mean, yeah, making a music video that was on Headbangers Ball, you know, with all the hair metal guys. Yeah. Kinnison was big time. Yeah, that's a great point that there was. You know, Eddie Murphy in Raw and the like leather outfit, you know, there was a rock stardom that started to enter into comedy, where it wasn't just stand-ups weren't just, you know, they were still the outcasts, but they were outcasts in the way that like rock stars were outcasts, you know, like this guy's weird, but he's cool.
And you could give more of a show than just a guy standing there talking into the mic, and even if you're not necessarily, you know, Dice didn't necessarily talk about, you know, hard rock and metal in his act. It was just all the attitude of it and to me that just, I was like, yeah, those are the kind of comics I like. Even Bobcat Goldthwait, you know, he opened for Nirvana on their first US tour. So it was cool back then for comics to open for bands, and then it was so not cool for like 25 years. So, you know, I'm proud to be in that group of guys who have been doing it now for a while again. You know, Brewer, myself, Dean, you know, he's been out opening for bands, Florentine, Craig Gass. So, you know, we're a small, we can all work, you know, we could work a nursing home, we could work a children's party, we could work a college, you know, a regular comedy club, but you know, we're one of a very small amount of people that will actually go out and face those hard rock and heavy metal crowds. And
yeah, I remember when Jim Norton had that show, I think it might have been on HBO actually, but where Lemmy was his DJ.
Yeah.
You know, and then he did the specials where, you know, Ozzy was in the intro and things like that. It is definitely like a subculture within a subculture of like comics who love metal. you know, there's a crew, and it's like, and it usually, if you're a fan of one of you, you're a fan of all of you. I would imagine you run into that a lot too, where people kind of group you guys together the same way that we're like, you know, Bay Area thrash bands, we group together, and new wave of British heavy metal, and, you know, the metal comics. So what was your first experience with Metallica? Obviously Kiss was pivotal for you, as it was for a lot of people, myself included, and a lot of people have been on the podcast, David Ellison. I'm sure, as you know, Kiss comes up in conversation a lot. When did Metallica enter into the picture for you? What was the discovery point?
Yeah, the discovery point was definitely, I was in high school, maybe a sophomore or junior, and went over to my buddy Eddie Van Curen's house because he had a hot mom, so we always used to hang at his house. And he was always kind of a half a step ahead of us in terms of music. And my first experience with hearing, you know, Kill 'Em All was like, I don't get this.
Right. Understandable. Yeah.
Like, this is too crazy fast. Like, this is nuts. Like, no, people can't play like this. You know, I was firmly like into, you know, Judas Priest and Iron Maiden and a lot of the new wave of British heavy metal at that time, Saxon. And so I was just like, yeah, this is like, no, this doesn't make sense. This is too extreme for me. And it's funny, now you listen to Kill 'Em All and you're like, you know, most bands play this fast now. But yeah, back then, you know, it's hard for people to remember, but back then that was outrageous. And so it took a while. It took to the second album. It took till Ride the Lightning for me to go, okay, yeah, I get this now. This is a little more refined, which I like. And and then I was a fan after that forever.
Yeah, it's definitely important for people listening who weren't of age in that era to understand that hearing something like Kill 'Em All in context of what had come before and what was around, it was like listening to Napalm Death for the first time, or Skrillex, or, you know, something that's just like, what? Like, I kind of understand what this is in the way that it relates to everything else, but it's so different and it's so crazy. Like, are these even people playing this? You know? it's easy to forget now. And like you said, you listen to Kill 'Em All now and it's like, oh, this is like a mid-tempo, like, Metallica demo, you know, but yeah.
I like that they were kind of ugly, you know, that was a turn on to me, because, you know, it was like, you know, at that point I was judging everybody by Motorhead standards, you know. It's like, if you're as ugly as Motorhead, I'll like you no matter what. And Metallica wasn't quite that ugly on the back cover of Kill 'Em All, but they were close.
They were trying, yeah.
I wanted to like them, yeah. But like I said, I was a little late with them.
I would say on the back of Kill 'Em All, even, that they were decent looking guys who were trying to look ugly. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like, they really went for it. It's kind of like the thing that, you know, Jared Leto and Johnny Depp, like, there's some of these celebrities where they're, some of these actor guys where they're so impossibly wonderful looking that you can tell they're tortured by it. And so they do all this stuff to like make themselves less attractive. It doesn't work, but they try so hard. They're so upset about how attractive they are. It's not quite that level, but I appreciated that, discovering the band early on myself in an era when, because I, you know, I came into them a little bit later. Master of Puppets was actually, Jason Newsted had really just joined the band when I discovered Metallica, and hard rock was dominated then by spandex and poofy hair and groupies, and that whole scene was extremely popular. And so, yeah, I appreciated that this was mean, fast, unattractive, harder to gain entry to, I suppose. You know, there was a little bit more gatekeeping to it. And it was still an era where when you saw someone with a Metallica patch, you were like, ah, my people, you know, like, we're you, me, we friends, you know, because there's only 10 of you in a, you know, a high school of, you know, hundreds. And I think that that's an attitude that has persisted, even no matter how big the band gets. There's still that same spark, that same skeleton, you know, that was there, that foundation. I feel like they've built on that, as opposed to, you know, moving two houses down or whatever, as some bands do. And well, I think that, that's why we're still talking about him, you know?
Of course. And because once I was on board, I was really on board. But who would ever think the biggest curveball Metallica ever threw me was Kill 'Em All after they've made albums like Saint Anger and Lulu?
Yes.
But I kind of got them by then. I kind of, you know, I understood them and I understood what they were doing. I always say this, you know, and you know, when Priest tried with the guitar synthesizers and, you know, on Turbo in that time period and where everybody was sort of getting poppy. But in general, I always did love the bands that tried something different, even if it didn't work. Very few exceptions, you know, Motorhead, AC/DC, pretty much stuck to the formula, but that really worked for those bands.
Absolutely. Not everyone can get away with that, but those two,
no.
You don't want much variation in that. You want a Motorhead record. You want an AC/DC record to sound like it's going to sound. And then you have bands like Metallica, who I think are more in that Zeppelin, Beatles, Pink Floyd sort of thing, where you have this expansive catalog that has all these different shades to it. And you can pinpoint a little bit like what decade it was or what was happening within the band or around the band, but that it was always authentic, that it was always what they wanted to be doing right then. And, you know, you often don't understand that as a fan until a few years pass and you can see it in the context of, you know, I'm so happy Saint Anger happened because it, you know, the band's survivability depended on it, right? Like they weren't going to be a band if they didn't make that record.
Right.
But at the time I was like, oh, this is so hard to listen to. But now I appreciate it for what it is.
Right. And then, they knew don't do that again.
Right. Yeah. It wasn't, this is our new sound for forevermore. It was more, this is a moment in time. Yeah.
Lulu was like, okay, I gave it a couple of honest shots to see if maybe, you know, I could figure out, you know, what they love so much about it. I didn't, but I also wasn't worried about them, you know, going out on tour with Lou Reed and doing 5 or 6 songs from the album.
Right.
So in that sense, that album didn't really piss me off. But I understood why they did it, because they could.
Yes. And I've said this on the podcast before, so I'll be brief, but my take on that is, I understand absolutely why it happened. You know, they jammed together at the Rock Hall induction and it's Lou Reed and they were, you know, opportunity to make a record. Cool. If it were up to me, that would have then been something that went on a shelf. And then someday when, God forbid, you know, the band can't record and tour anymore or they lose a significant member, you know, then it's this curiosity when they're a legacy band, when the greatest hits packages are coming out and the, you know, oh, did you know they made this weird art record based on a German opera with Lou Reed before Lou Reed died? It's weird. Then I think it could have been appreciated more. But I also, you know, I'm sure you've met him. He was probably on that metal show, which I watched every episode of. But, you know, so many guests were on it. It's hard to remember. That was Set Your DVR TV for sure.
Well, Lars came on he specifically called Eddie and said, I want to come on and defend Lulu.
So, oh, wow. Wow. I didn't know. That's amazing. I remember Lars being on there. And I think it was Alex Skolnick who opened me up to the idea that it's like, you're sort of not supposed to like it. Like, that's kind of the point, you know, there's some records that are challenging in the sense that it takes you a while to come around to him, but almost like that one, I don't know. He has this whole theory about it. He wrote a whole essay that he posted on his website. And when I had him on the podcast, I got him to go so far as to admit that he did talk to Lars about it. Lars did read his essay. And then he was coy and kind of tap dancing, but it sounded like Lars like confirmed that Alex's take on it was correct.
Right. Well, it worked.
Yeah, that it's art, you know, that it was just like, yeah, this is, I'm going to force this on you. And that's cool. I mean, I appreciate the punk rockness of making something that they knew people were going to have a tough time with and just doing it anyway.
Yeah. You know? And I always said after that, I said, as long as Dave Mustaine never runs into Arlo Guthrie, we're going to be okay. No more of these.
This is what happens when I invite a comedian on. I don't usually have these extended laugh breaks. So let's talk about that in your career as a journalist, one could say, right? Doing that metal show. Do you remember what the first Metallica experience was? First guy you had on, first, you know, what was the earliest connection between that metal show and Metallica?
So it was, you know, the first time Lars came on, it was, that was a different time than the Lulu time, but he had come on and, you know, he's just a guy that, you know, I know that he's obviously, he was the original heavy metal whipping boy. Again, looking back in the rearview mirror, it turned out he was right about Napster and all that stuff. And, but I'll tell you, man, when you get one-on-one with him, you know, you just turn 15 years old again with him. And, you know, I think he had worn like the Rock and Roll Heaven shirt, which was the flea market where
Johnny Z
had Megaforce and all that. And, you know, like we all geeked out over that together. And then he was cool enough. He invited us out, myself and Eddie and Jim and Brian Slagle from Metal Blade. And we went out and we drank to like 4:30 in the morning at the Chateau Marmont. And while the drinks get more expensive when you're in a band like Metallica and you're very successful, the conversation never changes.
Right.
I mean, we just sat there and he just played stuff off his iPhone, you know, I'll check out this Deep Purple bootleg I just downloaded. It's from 1971 and, you know, only three people have it. And, you know, so it was like a bunch of teenagers just sitting around listening to music, just with more expensive drinks.
And he was always that guy, right? Those are the stories you hear and stories I've been told on the podcast, but, you know, just had a guy on that has known him since they were teenagers. And yeah, he was the guy and the kid in Orange County that had all the new wave of British heavy metal records, that had the big extensive collection, that had a plan, that knew, you know, that had followed Motorhead on the road and talked his way into staying with Diamond Head and all this stuff before, you know, Metallica was even going and off the ground. And just that love and passion for the culture and the music that the culture is built around. I think that, you know, no matter what polarizing things he's done in the eyes of the public and some fans, there's just an unshakable earnestness and passion and sincerity about him. And I, you know, something I thought about literally just yesterday that I think is perhaps, you know, we know Lars the businessman, we know he's tenacious, we know all these things about him. I think probably my favorite thing about the guy is that he's curious. He's interested in things, even when it became the art world or when it became, you know, cinema and all these different things that he gets interested in. Like, he's curious about things. He wants to know about people. He wants to understand things and how they work and why people make the things they make and why things turn out the way they do and why something works and something doesn't. And I find that so just endearing about him. And I think it's such a important part of what makes that band work. You know, just
the more you absorb in life, no matter whether you're a guitar player, a singer, a comedian, or whatever, the more you absorb, the more you can bring to the table, you know, to your art. So I appreciate that too. But I think the biggest thing that I appreciate about all the guys in Metallica is that they've just never lost the fandom. They're just always still fans. You know, to have Hetfield, you know, say to me backstage at the Big Four in Indio, you know, shake my hand and say, hey, I hope you and Eddie and Jim know how important your show is to our business. Yeah. That's like, you
know. That gives me goosebumps. 8 years later, you telling me that. Yeah, that's amazing.
And, you know, he's a man of few words, you know. So the two or three interactions I've had with James were powerful. Because he doesn't say a lot, but when he says something like that, you know, you really take that to heart. So, and again, the same thing with Lars. He wants to listen to music and, oh, hey, have you heard this bootleg? Or I just got this, or what's King Diamond doing? And is he going to put a new album out? And like, he just, you know, the fan thing is off the charts. You know, Kirk Hammett coming on that metal show. He came on twice, mm-hmm. and he came on and we set up a jam with him and Michael Schenker. And
I remember that. An ultimate fanboy. Yeah, that's like one of his idols.
Yeah, freaking out. And so there's all these levels of geekdom, right? It's like, we're out there in front of, the audience, the live audience of people who are geeking out over that they're at the taping of that metal show.
Right.
We're geeking out at Kirk Hammett playing with Michael Schenker, and Kirk is geeking out over jamming with Michael Schenker. Yeah. So there's all these levels of geekdom and metal nerddom, and it's all pretty awesome.
I totally agree, man. And that's also what's so great about those guys is that the way they pay it forward, and that they've paid it forward from the very beginning. You know, it's like you look at the set list for their very first show, there's more Diamond Head songs than Metallica songs. And then even the Metallica songs, it's like, well, here's one that Mustaine brought in from Panic. Here's parts of a song that the Hetfield had in Leather Charm. You know, it was like they barely had a band, but they were just so into going for it. And then the way that, you know, since I started this podcast, having guys like Brian Tatler from Diamond Head and Biff from Saxon and, you know, Animal from Anti-Nowhere League, hearing the way that Metallica saluting them and covering their songs and flying the flag for them has like sustained these long careers for these bands that honestly otherwise would have disappeared into obscurity, you know, and the way that they've paid that back. And then they also continue to do that with new bands. I used to be the manager for the Dillinger Escape Plan once upon a time. And, you know, Kirk was just a huge champion of that band. And, you know, they put us on the second Orion Music Festival that they did. And, you know, Rob came out, introduced them. And one of my favorite memories actually is, well, first of all, at that one, they did the Kill 'Em All set, the surprise Kill 'Em All set on the first day of the festival, at like 2 p.m. They got up on the small stage and did Kill 'Em All start to finish. That was amazing. But then the end of the festival, when they did their big Metallica headlining full production out in the middle of the field, one of my favorite memories is myself and Greg, the singer from Dillinger, the Metallica, the Stern Pinball Machine had just come out, and they had them set up like in the artist area and whatever. And it's just me and Greg playing Metallica pinball for an hour, watching Metallica play in the distance. Just like, you know, as you said, they're the ultimate fans of music, both old and new. So when you hear, you know, of course Gene Simmons is the guy who likes to say this the most, but you hear it all the time, like people that are like, oh, there's no good bands, there's new good band, you know, nothing new under the sun, and there hasn't been a rock icon since blah 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 blah. And I think Metallica proves that wrong over and over. When you look at, you know, they take Gojira on tour. Like, that's an amazing band, and how many, you know, thousands and thousands of people are now being exposed to this amazing band that is essentially a new band, you know, and they're always doing that. So it's amazing.
No, and that's important. You know, that's the other thing. It's important to them to do that. You know, look at Volbeat. I mean, their career skyrocketed because of Metallica. You know, they took Ghost out. They've taken, you know, The Sword out. They've taken, you know, countless, you know, people out and gave them a stage and said, hey, you know, build an audience off of ours. You know, we want to support all these bands.
Lamb of God, that's another one. Yeah. That was a pivotal moment for Lamb of God.
You know, starting their own festivals, you know, I was lucky enough to be part of the first one. And being, like you said with Robert, like coming down and introducing the band, being hands-on, not just, hey, you know, we got a lot of money, we could put a festival on, hire a bunch of people, make sure the bands get on. They were going from stage to stage all day, because Lars came down and introduced me when we did the comedy show. So they were way into it.
Yeah. And I've heard from everyone I've ever talked to at this point, which is a lot, who are in bands that have supported Metallica and comedians. I recently talked to, you probably know Joe Sib. He's a buddy of mine, even him, but everyone who's been on tour with them, right, has a story about the band just like checking in on them, you know, Lars popping in the dressing room and being like, you guys okay, you got everything you need, is there anything else we can be doing for you, you know? And it's like, yeah, they they're in a position where not only do they don't have to do that, no one expects them to. You know, like if you got to, if your band gets a tour with Metallica, you're not going to be offended if the band isn't like paying attention to you. You know, but I always hear about those guys watching from the side of the stage and showing up at club shows in the Bay Area and stuff and seeing new bands, and it's amazing.
Yeah. That, and this is why I never farted on them, Ryan.
I believe in your trade, they call that a callback.
Yeah, yes, it is. I can't write any for my act, but I can do them on podcasts.
Yeah, improving them, no problem. I would love to just open the floor to any and all Metallica stories that you got. I'm sure you have several. You've had a lot of great encounters. What's your understanding of their relationship to comedy? Obviously, like you said, they've taken Jim Brewer on tour. They had you at their festival. They have a great sense of humor. You know, we've all seen and, you know, behind the scenes videos and things like that. What do you understand about their relationship to that?
Well, obviously it's important to them. Brewer, obviously, you know, very close with Lars and James in particular. Going on vacation with them and everything. And I was out with winter 2019, I was out with Pop Evil. And at the same time, Brewer was out with Metallica. Mm-hmm. And people were like coming up to me after the Pop Evil shows and going, "Oh, we just saw Metallica with Brewer and now you're with Pop Evil. And that's great." And they're like, "Oh, do you wish you got the Metallica gig?" And I'm like, "No, I go, no." I go, Brewer is the perfect guy for that gig. You know, you need a larger than life comic to open for a larger than life band. Not that I would say no if they asked, but
sure. Sib told me he ate shit the first couple nights and had to kind of get the pep talk from Brewer and from the Metallica guys that were like, "Don't worry about it. You'll hit your groove." That's an impossibly tough gig. Be out there by yourself.
A real tough gig, but luckily, like guys like me and Brewer and Florentine, you know, we at least have that recognition factor with the audience, so it doesn't come off completely weird. But nonetheless, it's still a really tough gig. But it was funny when we did Orion Fest. I did the day where they played Ride the Lightning in its entirety backwards. Yeah. And during the day,
I think the first time they ever played Escape, right? Or one of the first times. Yeah.
Begrudgingly.
Yes. Hetfield's favorite song, Escape.
He made some comment, like that. But he just said, "I thought I'd never play the song again." but in the daytime, it was myself and Florentine and Brewer at the Comedy Stage. And, you know, it's 4 in the afternoon. It's thousands of, Metallica fans and metalheads, and they're all sweaty. It's August, the middle of the day. Everyone's, already half hammered. And I got to go out there and do it 30 minutes. And it was like, I was terrified, dude. And then I see Lars come down in the golf cart. And, I had met all the guys at this point, and we were friendly. But it just shot my nerves up another notch, because I'm like, now what, Lars is going to see me. What if I bomb? I don't need this, Lars. Go somewhere else. Go introduce someone else. But thank God he did, because, that really lent me a lot of credibility, being the first comedian to perform at the festival. And I remember, man, I probably got about 12 minutes in before I took my first breath, because I was just so nervous and just, and I was having a good set. So by the time I finally took a breath, I was like, okay, yeah, good. I think we got this. I think we're going to be all right. So I tell another joke, and it gets a big laugh, but it gets a huge applause. And now I get cocky. I throw my hands up in the air, mother effers, I got this. And then I see everybody looking over to their left, my right, and I turn around, and there's Hetfield sitting on the speakers on the side. I'm like, oh, see, that was for him. I thought, all right, damn it.
That's amazing.
All right.
You're like, hey, can you do that again? I want to film this part for my next special. Just have him come out and stand behind you.
And then yeah. and then I walked off, and James shook my hand, and he just said, hey, at least we know comedy works at our festival. So that was another man a few words moment that really left a big impression on me.
It's like the Silent Bob idea, right? Like the character that doesn't say anything for 2/3 of the movie, and then when they do, it's this 5-page speech that, you know, tells the moral of the whole tale or whatever. Yeah, Hetfield's got that effect on all of us as fans and everything. It's amazing. So when you're in a situation like that, like you said, you're barely even taking a breath. That's then, right, where you just rely on the material, right? Like you're like, I've got my set. It's tried and true. You know, or are you also adapting the material to that environment a little bit? Knowing that it's, you know, a bunch of Metallica fans or.
Yeah, I was just starting at that time to develop, you know, a bunch of material about music and bands and stuff. Not to the extent that I have now. Now I can, you know, now I go out and support bands and I do a whole separate set than my regular act. That's just about music and bands and musicians. And by the end of the tour, half the set is usually about the band I'm with, because there's so much comedy when you're out on a tour bus with a band that it always ends up making its way into the act. So, but back then I was just sort of experimenting with it. You know, Jim and I had opened for Twisted Sister, and I think I had gone out with Rhino Bucket once and did a couple of gigs with Faster Pussycat. So I was starting to develop it, but it wasn't quite there yet. But I've always still do work. I like that element of danger. I like sort of the idea that I don't quite have this under control.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like when you would go see Guns N' Roses back in the day, and you're like, I might see the most blistering 3-hour incredible set, or I might see 1.5 songs and a riot. Yeah. and that's kind of part of the excitement of going.
Yeah. So I just sort of, I don't know, man, it was just a survival thing. It reminded me of, I was talking with Florentine backstage, and I go, you know, this reminds me of those hell gigs we used to do when we first started out, where, you know, we drive from Jersey out to the, like, all the way out to the middle of Pennsylvania, like 5-6 hours to like somewhere in the middle of nowhere, and it would be a bar gig, you know, for like $75. Yeah. You know, there was no hotel room. You had to drive home 5.5 hours after your set. You know, the microphone, there was a 50% chance it wouldn't work. The people sitting at the bar didn't even know there was a comedy show. They have the playoffs on the TVs. They won't shut off. Now you got to go out and be funny for 45 minutes. So
yeah. I'm picturing the Blues Brothers with the chicken wire, right? And the bottles coming at you.
Yeah, exactly. So I go, you know, we somehow got through it then. So I'm just going to take that same attitude. I'm just going to come out and attack. Yeah. And we'll see what happens, man. But luckily they were on our side. So it all worked out. And then it just snowballed from there. That's really when bands started saying, hey, you want to come out with us? And
yeah,
it became a thing.
I think it's a very cool thing. And like you said, it was a thing, and then it wasn't. There's that amazing story I'm sure you've probably heard or read with Bobcat when he was on the Nirvana tour that you mentioned in Chicago. There had been some big tragedy. I think it might have been, you know, Michael Jordan's father, or it was something, some big sports tragedy. And I heard Bobcat telling this story once on a podcast, but basically he came out on stage opening for Nirvana and just said, you know, did whatever joke that was just the wrong joke at the wrong time about the wrong thing, but also on purpose, because it was kind of a story about how that's the mode Bobcat was in at that time. But the story ends with, like, he had to have like a police escort out of the venue because the audience was ready to tear him limb from limb. So that's one way of opening for a band as a comic. but like you said, I hadn't really thought about it until you pointed it out, but there was a long period where I guess that wasn't quote unquote cool to do anymore, because you just didn't see it. Do you have any kind of handle on why that is, or what the change was, why one day it was cool, then it wasn't, and now it's cool again?
Well, because when you listen to grunge, you weren't allowed to laugh. So, this was very serious, dark, depressing music. You can't
That's a great point.
Can't have fun. And as much as I still like a lot of the bands from that era.
Sure.
The, comedy just didn't mix with it.
Yeah, that's a great point. I hadn't thought about that. I mean, yeah, of course, comedy mixes with Van Halen. Jeff Spicoli is the cinematic proof of that. I guess you don't want to have a bunch of laughs right before Eddie Vedder gets up and sings Black.
and then new metal came along and it didn't really fit there. Yeah. So, I think,
this song's about my horrific childhood.
Yeah.
Did you guys enjoy that stand-up comic? Yeah, Stephen Wright, wasn't he great? Anyway, this song is about my uncle. Yeah, it makes more sense. And you know what? There's probably more of an eclecticism too. I feel like I call it like the shuffle generation, post iPod. Used to be when we were growing up, it's like you're into this kind of music, you hang out with these kind of people, you look this way, you're into and now it just seems like it's so wide open where people like everything. So that's I would imagine that's probably helping too, where it's like, oh yeah, why not a stand-up comedian and then a DJ is going to spin a hip-hop set and then a black metal band is going to play. People are more like open to variety, I guess,
I've definitely noticed that over the last 10 years, Ryan. I mean, Kiss took a painter out on the road, so on that first part of the End of the Road tour, they had a painter for a while. So I would always tell crowds, if you liked me, I'm comedian Don Jameson. If you didn't laugh, I'm painter Don Jameson.
I didn't know Kiss did that. I remember. And it was, and they had Roth out with them, right? On the last, before the world ended. A painter. What did the painter do?
He was like a rock and roll painter. He had all choreographed to music and stuff. And, he had all kinds of crazy stage moves and stuff. But so, I think people are open to different, especially on,
that sounds very show. Paul Stanley, by the way. That had to be 100% Paul Stanley decision.
maybe that's how Paul, maybe those were the paintings Paul, he just, that guy did them and then Paul signed them and sold them.
Or maybe they met each other in their painting class.
Yeah.
Like, Tuesday nights.
You should open center. For us.
You can paint anything you want except for Ace Frehley's face. If that guy shows up, right. No painting his face. Oh, man. Yeah, so you mentioned the Pop Evil Tour. I've done, three or four, I think about every album. I usually end up getting hired to write their bios. So I talk to Lee every, year and a half. We get on the phone for an hour and talk about his new record and all that. Just the nicest guy. That band, they're one of those bands that, people don't realize they have like all these hits. As much as one can have hits in the rock world in the last few years. Like they always have these singles that are always on the active rock charts and always all over Octane and all those specialty shows. What were those gigs like for you? I must confess that I'm obviously very familiar with the band, but I've never seen them live. So I don't know what that audience is that finds them. What's the Pop Evil audience?
Yeah, no, well, they're younger audience, for sure, which was, obviously for me, that was good. And it was a challenge. When I go out with some of the older bands, like Faster Pussycat or people like, or Anvil, that's a little more in my wheelhouse. But Pop Evil was good. It was a challenge. But, dude, man, they treated me I was another band member. I can't say enough nice things about every single one of those band members and everybody on their crew. And when you do that with an opening act, you tend to get a lot more out of them. So I was grateful that they were so wonderful to me, because you know, I had a lot of anxiety going out and doing this. And I knew Matt and I knew Lee a little, I knew Haley a little, but I didn't know those guys that well. So when, you know, they made me feel at home right away. And it was just such a great tour. And, you know, we still talk all the time. And so that one was really memorable for a lot of reasons, but just mostly like made friends forever on that tour.
That's awesome. That's exactly what I would have expected just from, you know, Lee's the only one who I know, but he's so gracious. He's a sweet guy. He's very insightful. You know, yeah. He has like lots of like a really good handle on who he is and what their band does and what they're aiming for. And that's always a pleasure when I'm sitting on this side of it, especially if I'm writing a bio, to be talking to somebody who, you know, can put a sentence together about what his band is all about. That helps.
Yeah.
Helps.
Yeah. Except that he would fall asleep in the back lounge with the TV blasting and right by my bunk. Other than that, he's a delightful guy.
Luckily, I don't think I'll experience that. So, so I want to ask you before we wrap up in this, you know, and not to belabor the tired topic of the pandemic, but I'm curious for you as a comic, like I went to the Metallica drive-in show when they did that a while back.
Yeah.
I'm, you know, one of those people that actually still goes to the drive-in. There's a really cool one in Montclair, California called Mission Tiki. And my understanding is that it's a drive-in, someone who's wealthy through some other means, who loves drive-ins, bought it and refurbished it and has it as a running drive-in. So I don't think that it has to make money to survive, which is how it's still been operating. But anyway, it was already a cool place that I like to go. And that show was, you know, Metallica in any environment is going to be awesome. It was cool. It was funny seeing people tailgating and, you know, trying to make it feel like a concert. It was interesting. By contrast, 3 Days Grace, who were the opening band, you know, and everyone's trying to figure out what this looks like, right? And how to dance and everything. So I'm not dissing them by any means, but their performance, they were in a recording studio. There's no one there with them. And the singer's doing like stage banter, you know, like, I want to see you guys move on this one. And it's like, but dude, you're 3 weeks ago in a studio somewhere. Like, so that was weird. You know, if you know the words of this one, sing along. Like he was doing all the, you know, and he's also, he's not making eye contact with the camera. So he's just sort of looking off to invisible future people spread out around the country and drive-ins. So, you know, there's different ways to do this, all of which the long-winded thing I'm getting to here is on the comedy side. It's funny. I actually had tickets to see Anthony Jeselnik at Largo, which ended up being the last show at Largo before they closed. On a Wednesday night, and you know, this stuff was in the news enough that I was kind of like, do I want to go to a comedy show? Is this stuff going to get shut down? I ultimately decided not to go, and then it was literally the next morning where they sent out the email on their list that like, we're shutting it down. It was the last show last night. So the only comedy thing that I've done since then, two things. One is I went to a drive-in show at the Improv in Irvine. They do it on the top of the parking garage. And there's like an inflatable movie screen. And the comics are up there. They have a little improv background. They're up there on top of the parking garage and you're in your car. And there's a table with concessions. And yeah, they do their act and their broadcast on the screen. And that was weird. And then the other thing I did was,
but Ryan, the idea is that at the drive-in shows that you beep your horn in lieu of laughter.
Yes.
I mean, I assume people are laughing in their cars, but it's just so the comic can have some kind of, you know, audio feedback. Yeah. It's people beep their horns and if somebody called me, like in normal times, if somebody called me and said, hey, we're doing a driving thing and they're going to beep instead of laugh, I'll go, please don't ever call me again. And then Florentine did one down Atlantic City. And I go, how'd it go? He goes, I stood on the back of a pickup truck. I did my act. They beeped. And then that was it. I go, how was it? He goes, it was brutal.
Yeah.
And in pure comedian form, I said, oh, it was terrible, huh? Who books that?
That sounds awful. So are you going back and can I come with you?
yeah, exactly. So we're all adjusting to this new kind of world and everything's on the table right now, Ryan.
Well, this is what I was gonna tell you. Then the other version that I did, and it was Eliza Schlesinger and a few other comedians, but this was, I kid you not, and I apologize if this is old news to you anyway, but this was over Zoom. So exactly like we're doing now, except there's a studio somewhere with a stage, the comedian's on the stage, and then they're surrounded by giant flat screen TVs all over the walls. And if you pay a little extra to be VIP, your face can be in one of those screens as you're watching the comedian.
Yeah.
Which sounds super weird, but then when you do it, it's like, it's kind of cooler than the drive-in because, you know, the comic can actually see people and can hear you laugh. and they're like, they're doing crowd work, you know, like, oh yeah, Linda over there in the red shirt. Like, I mean, it's weird, but I don't know, that one, I think, you know, if I gun to my head, if I had to choose, see a comedy show on top of a parking garage in my car or sitting right here where I am right now via Zoom. I mean, the via Zoom was kind of cool. So
yeah, I did a Zoom one.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, okay. I did one Zoom show. I did a birthday party for someone in Seattle. So, you know, she had a whole virtual birthday party. She had a band. She had the band Junkyard play, and she had
DJ. No way. Junkyard, formerly featuring Brian Baker of Minor Threat.
That was okay? Yeah.
I mean, because, you know, they were like one of the hair metal bands that didn't quite make it, but that was their punk rock connection.
So it was cool. I put on a tank top and a vest and, you know, basically the top half of what I would normally wear on stage. No pants.
Yeah.
Put the phone up on my TV. I had my earbuds in so I could hear people laughing. I yelled into my phone for a half hour. 10 seconds after I hit leave, the money was in my Venmo and I didn't have to fly across the country.
Yeah. You didn't get a per diem. You didn't get to eat it like a strip mall Subway sandwiches. Yeah. You missed all the great stuff.
Yeah, I missed the scenic tour of the CHOP Autonomous Zone.
Yeah, you know, and now that you mention it, and it's funny because it's a buddy of mine who used to actually work for Metallica on their crew, but I went to a Zoom wedding a few weeks ago.
Wow.
Wedding was in Chicago. Bride and groom had like family there, like really small guests. Everybody's masked up, social distance. And then the vast majority of us guests were all watching via Zoom and watching them say their vows. And it was definitely nice to be at a wedding and to be able to, like, you know, mute myself and look at Twitter and, you know, like, do other stuff. You can't, it's not really cool to do that in a real life setting.
But, yeah, you're like, it's the greatest day for your friends, the man and woman getting married, and you're sitting there going, oh damn, the Rams are down by 12. Exactly. Scrolling through Twitter and Instagram.
Seven other devices going at the same time as the wedding's going.
Yeah.
Indeed. Well, dude, thank you so much for coming on. I'd love to have you back. This is super fun, and when I first sketched out the idea for this podcast a couple of years ago, you were literally in my, I've got a running file of wish lists. And so I was really happy.
Thank you for, man. Thank you for reaching out to me. And I got turned on to you recently through, you know, Biff from Saxon,
who
I'm close with. So
nice.
I'm enjoying catching up with all your interviews, man. You do a great job. So this is a real thrill for me, and I appreciate
awesome,
it.
Awesome, man. Dude, that means the world to me. That's like a little mini Hetfield moment you just gave me.
There you go. Unfortunately, I'm a man of many words, but only a few of them mean something.
balance in all things.